Hello, and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and today we are continuing our look at the book of Genesis. We're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 36 and 37 today. We're going ahead and put these two together just because of what we're going to be covering, what we're looking at. What's going to be coming up, and part of the reason for this is that we are essentially getting two genealogies, but at the same time we're going to be breaking off into the narrative of Joseph. So what we look at, of course, in verse and chapter 36 are the generations of Esau. Now, I had at first thought that I was going to go through and read all of this to you and put you through this torture of everybody's name. However, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to straddle away from that, and we are going to summarize, just talk about chapter 36, some of the things that are important for you to remember. Now, looking at these genealogies, I don't want you to walk away thinking, oh, okay, genealogy doesn't matter. No, it's extraordinarily important. It is very, very important. It's just that for us to try to look at this genealogy at the moment is going to be a little premature. Okay, the genealogy, the line of Esau that we are given here, goes way, 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 way past where we're going to be with the story of Joseph. It's going to become very important as we're looking at the later history of the nation of Israel, as far as, after the Exodus and coming into the land of Canaan, going throughout the time of the judges and the kings and the prophets, these kinds of things. It's going to play a major role. But what we want you to get from this, what God wants you to also get from this, is that the tribe of Esau, of course, is going to become the kingdom of Edom. Now, there's a couple of other lines that break off as a result of this. We have the Amalekites that come out of Edom. We have a couple of other ites that come out of Edom that are going to be really bad enemies of Israel. A lot of people kind of get this, I would call it a sympathy almost for Esau. A lot of people go, oh, well, Esau was hated by God at birth. You hear this very long lineup of, oh, woe is me, poor Esau, comments. However, the reason for how God felt towards Esau was completely justified because this is who Esau was going to become. And Esau becomes a man who has a generation of people that are materialistically more concerned, or excuse me, more concerned about things materialistically than they are about things that are spiritual. And that leads to these horrible, terrible nations that come out of Edom, and of course, Edom as being part of the problems that are going to come for Jacob and his descendants, of course, Israel. Now, when we are looking at the line of Esau, and we're about to be getting a more scoped view of the relationship between Jacob and his sons, the biggest lesson that we can learn here is that when we are not living for God, we are always going to breed problems in our life. We've talked about this, obviously, with chapter 35. We kind of got a little heated as far as dealing with parents go, because that job is so extraordinarily important. Parents do not realize just how much power and influence they have over their own children, I believe. I feel like, especially in this day and time, they think that the culture and friends and school and all that has much, much more influence than parents do. And that's absolute foolishness. Your children spend their time of unfiltered learning with their parents. They don't spend that with these different entities. And so what we see here is that Esau lives a horrible, terrible life, and as a result, his children do the same thing. Esau is not concerned about spiritual things, therefore his children aren't either. And that's really the breakdown of what we see here. We see how they become a thorn in the flesh of Jacob and Israel as a whole. And not only that, but we also see in chapter 36 that it was necessary for Esau and his brother Jacob to end up eventually going their separate ways because of the fact that they were both growing abundantly, even though Esau was not the one who received the birthright. He wasn't the one who received the blessing of getting to be the nation of Israel. Because he was a descendant of Abraham, he was still blessed abundantly. So that's kind of what is going on in chapter 36, and it sets us up for the discussion of just how much effect can a parent have on their kids. And that is going to play a major role in what happens here in chapter 37. And what happens, of course, is the story of Joseph. Now, if you have that, or the beginning of the story of Joseph. Now, if you have in any way, shape, or form ever read the Bible, ever watched a TV show about the Bible, if you've ever watched a VeggieTales, I'm sure you have touched on the story of Joseph. And we could summarize the story of Joseph very quickly. He's Rachel's son, not the youngest, that's Benjamin, but Rachel's son. And he is born, and his father, Jacob, excuse me, views him as basically as the favorite kid. Okay, he's the son of promise. He's the one who is going to receive the birthright. Now, we, don't know for sure a lot of the basis for Jacob's behavior, other than that, this was at the time Rachel's only son, actual biological son. But he was extremely happy with Joseph and played favorites with Joseph. And we know that Joseph, of course, he grows up and his brothers grow up and he's the favorite and he's the one that tattles on them, and he's the one that is basically their supervisor, even though he's one of the youngest of the boys. And so there's all of this hostility amongst Jacob and his children. So when we are talking about what kind of an effect does a parent have? Well, parents, first and foremost, you affect your children spiritually. You can see the difference in Jacob and his, or excuse me, in Joseph and his brothers, spiritually speaking, and that has a lot to do with Jacob. Secondly, parents have the ability to put their children in a position to fail. You go, whoa, 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 what do you mean by that? Everybody makes their own decisions. That's true, they do. But when we as parents do not do our job properly, we put our children in a position to fail. And that is what happens here very much with Jacob's oldest sons, who, of course, are going to throw Joseph in a pit. And second, thirdly, the last thing that we as parents have the ability to do is that we have the ability to be wrong about the things that we are doing. And you say, well, okay, what do you mean by that? Well, you're going to see that Jacob's reaction to the news about Joseph proves his own lack of spiritual maturity. So let's look here at what goes on in chapter 37. It says, "And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report." Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him, and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaf stood round about, and made obeisance to my sheaf." And his brethren said unto him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us?" And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it his brethren, and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to the earth to thee?" And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. So right off the bat, we're given quite an interesting look into the home and the life of Jacob in the later years of his children's growing up, basically. That, you know, at this point, all of his kids are essentially adults, even though Joseph is only 17. Typically, Jewish boys by the age of 12 to 13 were considered to be men. They had been raised to, you know, start their own lives and start to do the things that they ought to do. And so what we're looking at here is we have a huge dynamic problem. We have Joseph, who is Rachel's son, which is, of course, the favorite wife's kid. The kid, as it says, of Joseph's old age. All right, that he's, you know, he's the favorite. He loved him more than all his brethren. And he does something that is horribly ill-advised. And that is that he makes not only, you know, it's not only obvious by how he behaves that he loves this son more than the others, but he gives him a physical symbol that proves this is true. You know, when you and I were kids, if you had siblings anyway, when we were kids, you know, we would debate amongst each other, "Oh, we're mom's favorite." Okay? There was three of us, of course, so we had plenty of time to debate it. But there was never a time at which we actually believed that that was true. Why? Well, because my mother treated us equally. We all got in trouble equally. We all got loved on equally. That was how it worked. Now, we might try to convince each other otherwise, just for the sake of being rotten siblings. But at the end of the day, we never truly believed that our mother, quote-unquote, had a favorite. But that's not the case here with what's going on with Joseph, where it's this unfounded hatred that these other brothers have. It is very clear to everyone involved that Jacob has a favorite son. Now, I told you that the first point that I made earlier on in this is that parents spiritually have great power over their children. I said that you would be shocked to realize that parents have a much larger influence spiritually on their children than they think that they have. And this is very well proven here in what's going on. So notice that we have these 10 boys, well, 11 boys at the time. Benjamin will be coming here shortly. But we have these sons, and 10 of these sons are very worldly individuals. You know, here we have, of course, that they hate Joseph. We see that Joseph brought unto their father their evil report, meaning that Joseph tells on them, basically, and what they are doing. That they, you know, did wrong, did evil things that they were not supposed to be doing. And so we see that one son, Joseph, seems to be a son that has a good relationship with God, a great amount of respect for his father and for God. But then we have these 10 other boys that have no respect for their father, no respect for God, and absolutely hate their brother who does. How does that happen? How is it that we have in this family the same father? Now, you could argue not the same mothers, but the same father, the same spiritual leader, the same person who is the example to his children, yet have such a drastically different set of ideals, priorities, goals, and spiritual maturity as we have amongst these boys? Well, the proof is that Jacob, because he loved Joseph so much, he spent more time, he invested more effort, he invested more work in making Joseph spiritually sound. Whereas with his other boys, he really just didn't care. You know, as long as they grew up, they made good money, they didn't cause him any problems, he didn't really care what they did or how they turned out. Friends, one of the biggest things that we as parents need to learn is that we have a job in asserting in all of our children the same expectations, the same amount of love, the same amount of effort and work as we do in any of the others. Jacob has created this situation because he has not been the father that he is supposed to be. He has doubted just how much influence he has over the upbringing of his children. And God's people are doing this today. I've seen this many, many times amongst God's people, where we have this group of children, we have a couple of children, and it's almost like the parents just get tired. They start out with the oldest one, and they're really gung-ho. They're going to keep this kid in line. This kid's going to turn out right. They have very high expectations, and then as they get down the ladder, it's like they just baby these kids more and more and more and more and more. Okay? And we do that. And it makes sense, you know, when you're at your youngest is when you've had your oldest, and when you've had your when you've had your oldest child is when you were at your youngest, so you had a little more energy. And when you had your youngest, you were at your oldest, and you just kind of, you're at the point you want to just get all the chicks out of the nest. I understand it. However, not having that same expectation, not applying that equally, leads to this situation where we have these boys that have no respect for God. We have this one son that has a very good relationship with God, but he's also been treated so much better than the other one, so much more loved, so much more esteemed, that when God is communicating to him in these dreams, so of course the dream of the sheaves is, you know, you have this grouping of wheat, and Joseph's is in the middle, and his brothers is on the outside, and they all bow to him. which of course showed that he would one day rule over them, and that would have something to do, some connection to food, to grain, and we know how that's all going to work out in the story, and we'll get deeper into that as we're going. And then the next dream is essentially the same thing, but it includes his mother and his father. And even Jacob's a little shocked by Joseph's telling the story. He's like, you've first of all, I'm your father. How could it be that I would bow down to you? I am your father. You are supposed to respect me and your mother. As far as your brothers go, I don't really care. But with us, you need to watch how you talk. That's how he gets. Well, so we have these boys that absolutely hate their brother. We have this brother who, while he has a very good relationship with God, a good founding in God, he's got a little bit of an ego problem. We have the same father, but two very different groups of children. And this is because Jacob did not realize just how much influence he has over his kids. And parents, I promise you today, you have an extraordinary amount of spiritual influence on your children. You may not realize that, you may not even agree with me about that, but I promise you, it is 100% true. What your children see you do in your life is going to influence what they believe is right and can be done in theirs. We saw that in Esau's genealogy in chapter 36. We saw this now, we are seeing this now here in Genesis chapter 37 with what's going on amongst these boys. And so Joseph has these dreams, all right? And this, of course, has bred this hatred, all of these problems that are coming. And finally, one day, all of this comes to a head, which brings us to the next point of, as parents, we have greater spiritual influence than we realize. And then, as parents, we have a tendency to set our children up for failure. You say, well, whoa, 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 whoa. How is that the case? Well, you're going to see. It says, and his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, here am I. And he said to him, go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren, and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into some pit. Goodness gracious, I've got these little things on my page. It says, and we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no man hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. And it came to pass, when Joseph came unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hands be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites. For upon him, for he is our, or excuse me, for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brethren, and said, The child is not, and I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat, and killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the coat in the blood. All right. And now everybody knows this story. All right. I feel pretty confident that if you've been in church for any short amount of time, you have run into this story at some point. I would be very shocked if you had not. And so what ends up happening, of course, is that there comes a day. Jacob tells Joseph, Hey, go check on your brothers for me, please. Joseph says, Sure, I can do that. And Jacob says they should be over near Shechem. Interesting, because we were supposed to leave that area, but here we are again over near a Gentile worldly city that we're not supposed to be near. And he sends his son out. Now, this is what I mean by a parent can set their children up for failure. And what I mean by that is that because we have this spiritual influence, if we have not properly raised our children and we now know an issue exists, all right, there is a problem that exists amongst our children, we should not stoke that fire by escalating the problem further. Here, Jacob is not unaware that his sons have an issue. Jacob is not unaware that his sons have a problem with one another. Jacob is not aware that his oldest boys detest Joseph. And despite that, he has given him this coat. Despite that, he is sending him out in a position of authority to basically do a supervisor check-in on his older brothers. And so what happens is that Joseph goes out, he gets to Shechem, he looks around, and his brothers are nowhere to be found. They're not where they're supposed to be. And it just so happens that a man is out there in the fields as well, sees Joseph wandering about looking for his brothers, and says, Kid, what are you doing out here? And he says, Well, I'm looking for my brothers. Oh, yep, they were here earlier, and I heard one of them say that they're headed over to Dothan. That's where you're going to want to be, which is about another 15-mile walk west of Shechem. And so he heads out to Dothan, and his brothers are out there. I can only imagine what they are talking about and thinking. They already know that at some point there's going to be a check-in call from their youngest brother, Joseph. And so I'm sure they are have been trying to avoid this check-in. That's probably part of why they relocated the flocks to where they did, in an attempt to get away from their youngest brother. And they see him coming, and the reason that they can see him coming is because of this magnificent garment that he is wearing, that is not the garment of a worker or even of a man his age, but rather it's the garment of somebody who is of nobility, of privilege. And they finally have had all that they're going to take. The evil that has been in their heart, an evil intention that has been building up and has been stoking, is finally pushed into a roaring flame. And they say, "That is it. Let's kill this kid and throw him in a hole out here in the ground and go on about our life." Now, I agree that these brothers have already had these evil intentions. I agree that these brothers are wrong in what they are doing and they are acting in their own free will, but I also agree that Jacob has brought this to this point. Jacob has not addressed the issue. Jacob has not done anything that he can to assure his other children that he loves them equally. Jacob has not, in any way, shape, or form, put the amount of time and effort into taking care of his older sons as he has with Joseph. And he has certainly not instilled the same spiritual principles in his other sons as he did in Joseph. Joseph has the faith that he is supposed to have, but these other sons, they don't have that relationship with God, and that is 110% Jacob's fault. Friends, we set our children up for failure. We set our children up to lose in this game of life when we do not spiritually influence them the way we are supposed to. We have that power. We have that authority. We have been given that responsibility. And when we fail to do that, we are setting them up for failure. I've seen parents in my time of not just being a pastor, but being a preacher that, I've raised my daughter in church. I've brought her to church and she's gone and ended up pregnant outside of marriage. How horrible and how terrible. How could she do such a thing? And my response is always, before we talk about your daughter, and while you may have brought her to church, did you live it before her? Did you instill within her that this was important? And there's been many times that I've had that conversation of, well, let's not talk about the sin first. Let's talk about whether or not you did your job first. That I've gotten many angry looks because the immediate thing is, well, of course I brought them to church. Friends, bringing them to church does not mean you spiritually influenced them in the right way. You can have been taking your kids to church every single day, dragging, kicking, screaming every single service throughout their entire childhood. But if you did not live those qualities in front of them, you set them up for failure. Why should they believe and do something that you yourself do not do? Jacob here lived and did what he was supposed to do before Joseph, but he didn't do it in front of his other sons. And he willingly continued to push the envelope despite knowing the animosity that existed between these boys. And so they say, that's it. Let's kill him. And as he gets closer and closer and closer, Reuben, surprisingly enough, starts to kind of get a guilty feeling, and he goes, "Well, hang on, hang on. Let's not kill him right off the bat. Let's just put him in a hole." Again, Reuben is so concerned because he has not been spiritually founded. His father didn't teach him, "No, this is wrong, and I'm going to stand for the right thing." His father has taught him to try to outsmart other people. Because that's what Jacob has always done. And so he makes his own plan. Says, no, let's not kill him right off the bat, Let's toy with him a little bit. Let's just throw him in that pit and we'll leave him there and then we'll kill him later. And the whole time that Reuben's saying that, he is just like his daddy. He's got his own plan where he's going, okay, now once they put him in the pit, I'll sneak back over here later. I'll get him out of the pit. I'll take him back to dad. Problem solved. Because Reuben knew it was wrong to kill him. But instead of standing for what was right, because that's not what his father had ever showed him to do or done himself, he instead does what his father would do, which is try to plot and figure out how to make things work in his favor. And his favor. And so he decides, oh, well, this is a much more clever thing. Y'all just put him in the pit, we'll kill him later. And I'll come back and get him before they can kill him and take him back to Dad. And so they do this. He gets there, they strip him of his coat, they humiliate him, laugh at him, they throw him in the pit. They sit down and have dinner. He's more than likely crying out to them. We know that because of later on in the narrative. And they enjoy their dinner the whole while, just getting them a good chuckle of, oh, finally, that kid's getting what he deserves. He is such a pompous windbag. He's Dad's favorite. You know, and it's not just they're getting back at Joseph, they're getting back at Jacob also. Jacob set these children up for failure because he was not the spiritual influence that he should have been all of their lives. And thankfully, God knew this about their hearts, and it just so happens a group of slave traders is going by at the time, and they go, wait a minute. I mean, you know, if we kill him, his blood's on our hands, and, you know, he's our brother. I don't think we could probably do that and keep a clear conscience all our life. However, wouldn't it be great if we could get rid of him, but also make something off of getting rid of him? And so they sell him into slavery. And when they sell him into slavery, at some point Reuben had left after they put him in the pit. He comes back, and he's going to get Joseph out of the pit and take him home, and realizes Joseph is not there, and essentially looks at his brothers and says, well, what are we going to do? What have you done with him? What's the story? How are we going to fix this? And this is where I said that parents, not only do we sometimes not realize how powerful our spiritual influence can be on our children, that we can sometimes set our children up for failure, but also that we can fail as parents to investigate things further. We show that lack of spiritual influence, that lack of faith in our own behavior, because look at what happens. So they make their plan, right? They've sold Jacob. It says, they sold Joseph, okay? It says, and so they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and there we go, get that off of there. Lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes, and he returned unto his brethren, and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat, and killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father, and said, this have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without a doubt rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him, and the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. We not only as parents don't realize how strong our spiritual influence is, we don't just as parents sometimes set our children up for failure, but we fail our children with our own behavior. Here, they come to Jacob, and they do one of the most evil things in the world. They know that it, of course, is Joseph's coat. They know, of course, that Joseph is not dead. But they make it look as if Joseph is dead and come to his father, Jacob, and say, oh, is this your kid's coat? And Jacob, look at his reaction. He immediately rends his clothes, goes into that sign of mourning, which is understandable, but he just assumes that it's true. He knows what's going on between these boys. He knows the animosity of his children. He knows that Levi and Simeon committed mass murder. But he does not question or investigate what happened to his son, the son who everybody hated, Joseph. And not only does he fail as a parent to live in the realm of reality that his children may be lying based off of prior experience, he also overmourns the loss of this child. He reinforces what brought all of this into fruition, which is that he only loved Joseph. And so he's going to spend the rest of his days mourning over Joseph. He doesn't turn to his sons and his daughters and say, I know I lost Jacob. I know I haven't been the best of fathers to you guys, but I love you guys too, and start to form good relationships with them. Because, see, friends, if he had done that, if he had started to try to form good relationships with them, if he had repented of his mistakes as a father, I firmly believe his sons would have said, "Daddy's not dead. I'm so sorry. He's not dead. We lied to you. This is what happened." And the whole story of what goes on with Joseph would have been entirely different. But Jacob continued to fail as a parent. His actions and knowledge of his own kids don't line up because he doesn't investigate what happens to Joseph. He just assumes it to be true. He doesn't turn around and display the love that a father should have for all of his children and start spiritually influencing all of his children. He instead chooses to spend the rest of his days mourning the death of this one special child. Guys, we as parents, we not only need to be using our spiritual influence so that we don't set our children up for failure, but we need to have actions that match that influence so that we do not fail in our role as a parent. There are so many times that parents get caught up in other things that do not matter, that are not important to the actual raising of their child that they think is important, such as extracurriculars and sports and all of these things, and we put that stuff as precedent over the things that really matter, which is God and His Word and growing as people, not as, just athletes or academics, okay? And when we do those things, our actions fail our children. Our lack of spiritual influence causes our children to fail. So, if you're on here and you're a parent, as you're going about the week, I have a few challenges for you. Number one, stop dismissing your influence. Stop thinking, I don't care if your kid's 15 years old or two. You have an influence over your child all of their life. That is because you are their parent. Use that influence and the power that comes with it to raise your children properly and found them properly in the Word of God. Secondly, do not be a parent who sets your children up for failure. If you know your child is going to fail spiritually at something because you have not founded them in it, but you allow them to be in that situation, you are a fool. If you know that your daughter is someone who is not spiritually founded in men and what they should be looking for in men, and you're going to let her go on a date with a boy that you can already tell is a pig, and she might end up in a situation where she commits sexual fornication outside of marriage, you are a fool for letting your child go into that situation. If you know that your son is somebody who is easily influenced by other people because you have not founded him into caring about the opinion of God, but only in, and he's more worried about the opinion of his buddies at school, and you're going to let him go over to a hangout with his buddies at school who you already know are of questionable character, you are a fool. Do not set your children up to fail. Especially when you already have set them up to fail because you haven't spiritually influenced them the way you should have. And finally, do not let your own actions fail your children. Do not be somebody who lives their life as a do as I say, not as I do mentality. Show your children, especially in the face of trial, that they can rely on God, that there is truth in having faith in God, that you as a parent, as someone who says you are a child of God, you believe in what God's word says and demonstrate that in your life. Because when you fail to have let your actions line up with what you tell them is true, you are not only failing them, but you're failing yourself as a parent. And so, that has been Genesis chapter 36 and 37. We will wheel back a little bit to that Esau genealogy as we get a little further on in the Bible, because there's going to be a couple of things that are talked about there that are going to be very, very relevant for our studies when we get into Exodus and Leviticus and Judges and all of those time periods. But I hope that all of you learned something today. We are officially caught up. That is the last chapters for this week. Chapter 38 will go out this coming Monday. And now we're back to where we are supposed to be in our Genesis study. I hope that all of you have an excellent week. Pray for all of you. Love all of you. And as always, you guys get out of here and go study.